Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on climate change right after this. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of about 7%. Now, today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of the tax have been more than fully realized, because by the end of Herbert Hoover's term, 1932, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%. And the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. Now, in 1913, the average family had to work until about January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man at every level. Now, this year, the average American family had to work through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, in those days they only had to give the lord of the manor or pay a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what do you think that makes us today? Now, this income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. And the income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank. That's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call us at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free. Now, our Tax and Status School is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, we're talking about climate change, global warming. In the last program, I pointed out to you that this is the biggest tax increase in the history of America. It's going to burn us to the tune of 77 cents a gallon. Now, that's the initial first shot come out of the Office of Management and Budget. 77 cents a gallon for gas. And it's going to double our power bills. So, I mentioned that I was paying $2,500 a year for power, and in the next couple of years, my power bill is going to go up to $5,000. And if you drive, say, 15,000 miles a year, your gasoline bill is going to go up by about $750 a year. That's money out of your pocket that you won't be spending for something else, but that money is going to be collected by ExxonMobil and Shell. It's going to be collected by your power company and turned over to the federal government. And it's going to fund the United Nations and the International Monetary Fund. It's not going to fund, or it's not going to put people to work here in the United States. It's not going to fund your public schools. And it's not going to build highways and fill in the potholes and build bridges. Now, I'm not here to make an observation or to make any comments about whether this is a good or bad tax. That's not my point. My point is that global warming is a fiction. Global warming is a fiction. It is an excuse that's being used to raise the tax. And what they want to do is tax, and they got to have some crisis. You know, in World War One, we had a crisis, so it created war. World War Two was a crisis. Now that gives us the excuse to tax and spend. But once World War II ended, then why don't we just go back home and go back to doing what we were always doing? Well, then what excuse would big government have for existing unless there's something that big government can do? So they created the Cold War, and that lasted for about 40 or 50 years. But in 1990, the Cold War ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union. What do you need a Cold War government and a Cold War expenditure for? So we've got to come up with some new crisis, and the new crisis is global warming. Now, global warming is blamed on greenhouse gases. The Industrial Revolution is unleashing carbon dioxide in the air, and that's causing the temperature to go up. That's a fiction. It is true the temperature is going up, but that's because of a cycle. At the end of the Little Ice Age, which lasted from 1550 to 1850, we went through a cooling period. The cooling period ended in 1850, and from 1850 until today, the temperature around the world has been increasing. It was increasing from 1850 to 1950 before anybody thought about greenhouse gases. And it's still increasing, and it's going to continue to increase. No matter what you do about carbon dioxide or carbon taxes or your war on carbon or your war on carbon dioxide, it's going to continue until the cycle ends. Now, these cycles last about 300 years. So just based upon what we've seen in the past, we could expect another 150 years of continued global warming. Now, one of the observations that they make is that this is going to kill the polar bears. So in this Heartland Institute book that I introduced to you last time, this is Climate Change Reconsidered, the report of the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change. Now, there's a government-sponsored international panel on climate change, and they gave a report, and they said the world's coming to an end, and we've got to do something drastic, and if we don't, God help us all. And we see this bandied about on the news every night. There isn't a news broadcast that doesn't contain something about global warming or a statement that, well, we're in this global warming and we've got to solve this problem. And the president the other day was talking to the G8 people, and he mentioned global warming, and we're going to join in. So the rest of you people around the world, you know, bend over, get your Vaseline out, because it's coming your way too. You're going to have climate change whether you like it or not. So let's take a look at these polar bears, because I was watching a PBS special not too long ago. And they had a wildlife biologist on there, and he gave a little speech, and he said that the polar bears are being killed by climate change, that the global warming has to be stopped, and if it isn't stopped, God help us all, and especially the polar bears. And they put on an hour special, and they told us all about the polar bears. Now, these polar bears are up on Hudson's Bay, up in Canada, and they said they're declining in population, and their food sources are drying up, and the ice has gone out, and they don't have enough ice, and they don't have enough seals, and, you know, just went on and on, told us the story. Now, there isn't any reason for us not to believe the story, because why would a scientist, why would PBS, why would government, why would any of these people come out and lie to us? What would be the purpose behind it? Okay, let's take a look at the purpose. They want an emergency, they want a crisis, and polar bears tug at a certain segment of the population. If you were to ask me what I thought about polar bears, I couldn't care less. So if you came to me and said, oh my God, the polar bears are dying out, therefore we have to spend more money on taxes so that we can stop global warming, you haven't got my vote. So there's a number of people out there, though, that are very concerned about wildlife. You know, green people and the greenies and PETA and, you know, all these people out there. And so that's the audience that they're shooting at. So you've got audiences of construction workers and audiences of scientists. And then there's audiences out here of actors and audiences, you know, that are interested in ecology. There's various constituencies out here that politicians are shooting for. And so what they're shooting for here on polar bears is the animals' rights people, or the PETA people, and the ecology people. And so that's a number of people. There's millions of them, and they're sitting out there, and they're watching this PBS special just like I am. And I believed it, just like you and anybody else would. I couldn't figure any reason why they'd want to lie about it. And they said, these polar bears are dying out, and there's fewer today than there was, 10 years ago. And he said, now the reason for that is global warming. Now, I would sit here and say, well, I'm not sure that global warming did it, but now that we've got this polar bear problem, I guess we should address the polar bear problem. He wants to address the polar bear problem by cooling the temperature of the world, by eliminating carbon dioxide emissions. And I'm sitting here saying, well, I'd like to save the polar bears, but I'm not really sure that I want to pay 77 cents a gallon of gas to do it. So here comes the Heartland Institute, and they have a group of scientists, and they did a study, and they put all the facts and figures together and come to an exact opposite conclusion, and that is the polar bears are not dying out. Polar bears are actually gaining in population. The polar ice caps are not melting away. There is no threat to the polar bears in the Arctic. And so then this leaves us with a dilemma. Who are we going to believe? And why would one side be lying? I mean, if the polar bears are in fact dying out, why would this group of scientists say, no, it's a lie, they aren't dying out? If the polar bears aren't dying out, then why would that group of scientists come to us and say, oh my God, the polar bears are dying out, we've got to take action fast? So I got to thinking about it a little bit, and I think I can tell you the answer. Little Tommy Pettit, when he was born in Brooklyn, New York, was the pride and joy of his family, and so they sent him off to public school when he got to be 6 years old. And as he went through the public school system, little Tommy Pettit was learning from his teachers, who constantly told him about the earth and the greenies and the polar bears and all the problems that are going on. And by the time little Tommy got to be a senior in high school, he had been fully persuaded that he needed to go to college. What he needed now was a major. And so when he went to his counselors, they said, well, what are you interested in, Tommy? And he says, oh, I like animals. Ah, you like animals. Tommy, you should pursue a career in wildlife biology. So little Tommy goes off to college, and he does all those things that little college boys do. When he got all through with college, he came out with a degree and said he was a wildlife biologist. Now, little Tommy Pettit with a degree in his hand needs a job. And so normal people, when they get a degree from college, say in computers, they go out to a computer store or they go out to a computer company. And they say, well, give me a job. I'm a computer graduate, and so I want a job in computers. If a guy has a degree, let's say in accounting, he goes out to some accounting store like H&R Block and says, give me a job because I can count. But what does a wildlife biologist do? Does he go down to the wildlife biology store and say, give me a job, I'm selling wildlife biology? Who in the hell has a need for a wildlife biologist? Where do they work and what do they do? What do they produce? What do they sell? How do they fit into the economy? Well, the answer is they don't. There aren't any wildlife biology stores. Now, the guy could go back to the colleges and universities and say, well, I would like to teach wildlife biology. So now we have a closed circuit. We have wildlife biology teachers, and we have wildlife biology students, and the wildlife biology students are paying their tuition through their families, who are giving them the money to send them to college to listen to the wildlife biology teachers teach them wildlife biology. And then when they get out of college, we'll have a lot more wildlife biology graduates who are going to do what? Teach wildlife biology? So pretty soon, these people become a surplus in the marketplace because there isn't any jobs for them. So we have to create some employment to keep these people off the streets and out of the pool halls. And so Colleges and universities wanting to sell their wildlife biology classes have to have a place to employ people with wildlife biology degrees. So they go to Congress and they say, what we need is a Bureau of Wildlife Biology. We need some kind of a government agency. And so Congress appropriates money to study the problem and to employ people to go out into the field with the various agencies of government. So maybe it's the Bureau of Land Management, or maybe it's the Department of Agriculture that hires some of these newly created spots, and they go out and they start studying wildlife biology. Now let's take little Tommy Pettit. Now he's studying wildlife biology. He goes up to Hudson's Bay, and his job is to study the activities of polar bears. If he were to write a report and come back and say, polar bears are increasing, there's no problems up here, polar bears are eating seals, and everything is just honky-dory, how in the hell are we going to persuade Congress to give us another $10 million next year to come up here and study polar bears if there's no problems? So little Tommy, with a government grant now, has a motive for making up a report that says polar bears are decreasing, the seals aren't there, the ice is disappearing, it's the problem that's caused by global warming, and we need more money to fight this problem of the decline of polar bear populations. Well, that's what's actually going on, because there are people out here all over the world, Russian scientists, you know, Canadian scientists, American scientists. There are Norwegians and Swedes and Finns. There's all kinds of people around the world that are studying polar bears. And the polar bears are not decreasing in population in Siberia, Alaska, Finland. They're decreasing in population around Hudson's Bay, and that's assuming that their report is true, and I suspect that the report was false. So the Heartland Institute put out an 850-page report to refute this climate change reconsidered by another group called a non-governmental group. So you have the governmental group represented by Tommy Pettit, and then you have the non-governmental group represented by the Heartland Institute. And there's about 70 categories of subjects over here that are being looked at. Now, listen to this. You've heard it, and you know it. Climate change is here, temperatures are going up, and it's affecting us and causing droughts, floods, tropical cyclones, variability in precipitation, storms, snow, storm surges, temperature variability, wildfires. Coral reefs are disappearing, polar bears are disappearing, it's causing disease, nutritional deficiencies, human longevity is being affected. We've got all of these problems that come up because of this global warming. Now, we've been told that for about 15 years. It must be true. All of these people talking about global warming couldn't be wrong, could they? Could 80 million Germans be wrong about Adolf Hitler? Could 60 million Americans have been wrong about George Bush? I mean, you know, we've made mistakes in the past. Has it occurred to anybody that maybe we've made a mistake with this global warming? So let's take a look at the other side of global warming as it relates to polar bears. According to the IPCC, now remember this is the International Panel on Climate Change. This is the governmental people. Now they're telling us this global warming is inducing declining survival rates, smaller size and cannibalism among polar bears. Reproductive success in polar bears, the IPCC also claims, has declined, resulting in a drop in body condition, which in turn is due to melting Arctic sea ice. Without ice, polar bears cannot hunt seals, their favorite prey. Later in the same report, the IPCC claims to have very high confidence that substantial loss of sea ice will reduce habitat for dependent species, such as polar bears. As was the case with the coral reefs, the IPCC's claims and predictions are based on computer models and untested theories rather than real-world data. They are at odds with much of what is known about sea ice, polar bear populations and behaviors, and the natural ability of wildlife to adapt to climate change. So in this section, we review the evidence and conclude polar bears are not endangered by global warming, whether it's being caused by human activity or any other cause. And since our findings once again contradict those of the IPCC, we summarize them here. So I have five summaries. Now listen to this. There is little or no evidence of global warming-induced reduction in the extent or thickness of Arctic sea ice in the second half of the 20th century, and particularly during those seasons when polar bears rely on it to reach their favorite food supply, seals, despite what the IPCC calls the unprecedented warming over the past century. Now, last time I pointed out to you that they took a picture of the Arctic Ocean by satellite in 1978, January of 78, and it showed that the whole Arctic Ocean is covered by ice. They took a picture of the same Arctic Ocean in August of 2007 and said, oh my God, look at how much ice has melted. Which is like taking a picture of your front yard in January and then waiting until August and taking another picture and saying, oh my God, what happened to all of the snow? It melts off every single year, and the Arctic Ocean melts back about 50% every single year. But you see, when they put that story out, they put it out under the context of, well, seeing is believing. Here's a picture in 1978, here's a picture in 2007, and the Arctic ice is half what it was in 1978. Well, duh. For crying out loud. The deception here is that they took one picture at the end of summer and the other picture in the middle of winter. And of course, the half of the Arctic ice is going to be gone. And that's the kind of ruse that they're using here with these polar bears. Now, I'm all in favor of polar bears, and I'm not here to exterminate polar bears. If there's a problem, we ought to get after it. But creating these artificial problems for the purposes of putting people to work in government and in dead-end jobs that don't do anything for you or for me and have no reason or purpose for being. I mean, we could come up with a bureau of fly studies so that we could study the nocturnal habits of flies. And maybe it would be well worthwhile, and maybe we need some information concerning flies, but I really don't want to pay 77 cents a gallon for gas increase to study flies or to study non-existent polar bear problems. Now, government wants to do that. Bureaucracies want to do that, and they've got an agenda, and they've got a reason for it, and it makes them money, but it doesn't make me any money. The second conclusion they came to was that polar bears have survived changes in climate that exceed those that occurred during the 20th century or are being forecast by the IPCC's computer models. Now, they've got these computer models that they're relying upon. And there's an old adage concerning computers. It says, garbage in, garbage out. Now, there are real-life studies going on. I mean, there are people out in the fields. And in the manual here, there are a number of these studies that are in the references. So just looking at the references here, I'm going to turn over here to page 644 and page 645. There are 36 references of studies being made in things like, just picking one at random, variability of Arctic sea ice, the view from space, and an 18-year record. Here's one over here called Grummet, Wake, and Maluski, studying the variability of sea ice extent in Baffin Bay over the last millennium. There's another one down here, Johansson, O.M., Chelina EV, and Miles, Satellite Evidence for an Arctic Sea Ice Cover and Transformation, Science, page 286. There are studies going on in the real world right now that refute these arguments being made by these climatologists and scientists that have an axe to grind. works like this. I'm a scientist, and I want a $1 million grant. I go to the government, I fill out my request, and if I file a report that says that the sea ice is melting and the polar bears are dying, I get a $1 million grant. And if I file a report that says the polar bears are fine and the sea ice is growing in size, I don't get my grant. Now, what kind of a report do you think I'm going to write? We can get the kind of reports that we buy and pay for, and government is buying and paying for reports that support their argument that global warming is a threat to everybody. And they've got an agenda. They want to raise taxes. They've got to have an emergency to raise taxes. To spend this money on global warming, to solve this massive worldwide problem, we got to have money, boys and girls. And we need to persuade you that we need to get this money from you, and you need to pay these taxes and be willing and ready and able to pay those taxes to solve this problem. Just like you were ready, willing, and able to pay those taxes to win World War I, World War II, and to fight the Cold War. This is the new emergency. We have to have your money. So let's take a look here at temperatures in Greenland and other Arctic areas exhibit considerable variability described by one group of scientists as a long-term cooling and shorter warming periods. Most populations of polar bears are growing, they're not shrinking, and the biggest influence on polar bear populations is not temperature, but hunting by humans, which historically has taken too large a toll on polar bear populations. And forecasts of dwindling polar bear populations assume trends in sea ice and temperature that are counterfactual. Or as Samuel Clemens used to say, well, Mark Twain, he says, there's lies and then there's damn lies, and this is one of those damn lies. Now let's take a look here at Arctic sea ice. Global warming is thought to endanger polar bears by melting sea ice, according to a 2004 study by DeRocher. It is unlikely that polar bears will survive as a species if the sea ice disappears completely, as has been predicted by some. Now, we note here that even the IPCC's computer models do not predict the disappearance of all the sea ice. So this widely cited warning is essentially meaningless. Amstrup et al. In 2007 says, our modeling suggests that realization of the sea ice future, which is currently projected, would mean a loss of about two-thirds of the world's current polar bear population by mid-century. Now, these dire predictions are based entirely on computer simulations of the effects of warming temperatures on the extent of sea ice in the Arctic region if it were to melt off. Boys and girls, Arctic sea ice isn't melting off. It's about the same today as it has been 20, 30, 50 years ago. In fact, they've got studies all over the Arctic region. They study the sea ice at Baffin Island. They do over in the Baltic Sea. They do it in the Arctic Ocean. They do it around Siberia. And around the Arctic Ocean, in some years, the sea ice will melt sooner and break up is sooner. Sometimes it's later. And sometimes they have thicker sea ice, and sometimes it's thinner, depending upon the year and the location. The Arctic sea ice may be thicker or thinner in Siberia than it is in Baffin Island, as it is in the Baltic, or as it is, let's say, at Prudhoe Bay. And there are people up there measuring it every single year and have been for the last 150 years. In fact, they've got measurements here of the sea ice as we read through this report that go clear back to the 1500s for the last 500 years. Now, I would say that 500 years of factual measurements is more important to us than computer models that are put together by people who have an axe to grind in order to get 77 cents a gallon in tax revenue. Now, if I was a scientist and it was dependent upon my report so that I could get a 77 cent tax increase so that I could continue my livelihood, I'm sure that I would write a report commensurate with the grants I was receiving from the hand that was feeding me. Now, the popular media is filled with reports about the disappearance of sea ice at the North Pole and the possibility of an ice-free summer in the region. The IPCC also focuses on summer, August and September, minimum Arctic sea ice extent, and then downplays the evidence showing relatively little change in sea ice extent at other times of the year. And this shows relatively stable March sea ice extent, but it receives no comment on the text. Summer ice losses are part of an eons-long natural cycle to which polar bears have adapted in order to survive. Polar bears are able to fast for more than 4 months at a time while they're fully awake and mobile without hibernation, as other bears do. And that's a study made by a fellow named Watts and Hansen in 1987, another couple of guys, Ramsey and Sterling in 1988, and Ramsey and Hobson in 1991, and Lennox and Goodship in 2008. Let's think about it for a minute. Polar bears have been up there for thousands of years. And over the thousands of years, the temperature has risen by as much as 10 to 15 degrees Celsius above what it is today. So if you take a look at the warming period between 600 and about 1200 AD, the temperature here on the Earth, on average, was 10 degrees warmer than it is today. So far, the temperature rise that these guys are talking about through the entirety of the 21st century is going to top out at about 3, maybe 4 degrees. How we've already been through a warming period for 600 years, three times that great, and the polar bears didn't become extinct between 600 and 1200 AD now, did they? Because if they did, there wouldn't be any polar bears up there today. So they obviously then had to adapt in that 600-year period, didn't they? Now, what in the hell makes us think they won't adapt in the next 600? Now, if you're a government agent out here and you're trying to stir people up and get them excited, you know, well, the president's doing a great job. I got to give him credit for that. I mean, he comes out and he says, hey, we got to solve this problem. And they're not talking about any longer there is a controversy between is there global warming or not. Everybody's in agreement that there is. The controversy is over did this global warming occur as a natural phenomenon in a cycle or a cyclical pattern, or is it caused by humans and the Industrial Revolution? And the answer has already been turned in. It's caused by humans, it's caused by automobile exhaust, it's caused by industrialization. And we've got to solve this problem. We caused it and we got to solve it. Now that's already in. That's past tense. That's what they've told us. That's what they've accepted. Tain't so, but that's the premise that we're working on right now. All right, we're at the halfway point here, and I got to give you a reminder if I can find my paper. If I don't find my paper, I won't give you a reminder. Here it is. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. And it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package Be sure to order one by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Heartland Institute manual, their new 850-page book. I just received this in the mail a couple days ago. Pretty impressive catalog, I'd say. It's about the size of a Sears Roebuck catalog, too. 850 pages. Climate Change Reconsidered, the report of the non-governmental International Panel on Climate Change. Bear with me, I'll get it out. The report of the non-governmental International Panel on Climate Change. There it is. $154 a copy. Unless you want to buy 101 copies or more, the price drops to $79 each. I thought that was special. This is published by the Heartland Institute at 19 South LaSalle Street, Suite 903, Chicago, Illinois, 60603, here in the United States of America. Telephone number is 312-377-4000. That's 312-377-4000. If you want to bedazzle all of your friends at the dinner table, you need a copy. Put out by the Heartland Institute. Their webpage is www.heartland.org. Easy enough, heartland.org. And about 70 topics in here, covering Arctic sea ice and polar bears. Now, I told you there was 36 reports, 36 studies, actual physical studies, 36 books have been written by PhDs. Ranger Rick has been up there investigating the polar bears. There are biologists who are up there studying the polar bears, and they, some of them, give us a different report than we're getting from the government. There are Russian biologists, Finns, Swedes, Norwegians, Canadians, and Americans studying and writing books about polar bear populations, and they're studying, taking measurements, and writing books about the Arctic sea ice. The number of days, for instance, that the port of Riga, Latvia, is bottled up by ice and when the breakup comes. And not just last year or the last 10 years, but for the last 300 years. And their conclusion is that there's little or no change today than there was from 300 years ago. 300 years ago, we were in the Little Ice Age. Now we're in the warming trend after the Little Ice Age ended in 1850. So by 1950, that's the first 100 years. 2050 will be the second 100 years. 2150 will be the third 100-year period. We will probably be in a warming trend until the year 2250, probably. We were in a warming trend from 600 to 1200, a 600-year warming trend, 600 AD to 1200 AD, and the polar bears did not disappear. They made it. And that warming trend, the temperature on planet Earth was 10 degrees centigrade hotter than it is today. And they made it without a 77 cent a gallon tax increase, and without any interference by human beings at all. The polar bears toughed it out. Now let's take a look here at polar sea ice. In another study of Arctic climate variability, Olmsted and Chen in 2001 obtained a proxy record of the annual maximum extent of sea ice in the region of the Baltic Sea over the period from 1720 to 1997. 1720 to 1820 to 1920 to 2020 would be 300 years. So this is 275 years of study. In analyzing this record, they found that a significant decline in sea ice occurred around 1877. In addition, they reported finding greater variability in sea ice extent in the colder 1720 to 1877 period than in the warmer 1878 to 1997 period, suggesting that air temperatures are not the main force at work in determining sea ice extent. Okay, very important paragraph. Here's a couple of guys named Olmsted and Chen. They studied the records of sea ice between 1720 and 1997, and they found that in the cool periods, the sea ice would be less extensive than it is during warm periods and vice versa, which led them to the conclusion that the atmospheric temperature is not the determining factor as to how thick the ice is going to be, or how much ice we're going to have, or when it's going to break up, or how long it's going to be in the harbor. There are other factors involved. Now, in 2001, a fellow by the name of Jevreva, spelled J-E-V-R-E-J-E-V-A, however that's pronounced, Mr. Jevreva, reconstructed an even longer record of sea ice duration and therefore extent in the Baltic Sea region by examining historical data for the observed time of ice breakup between 1529 and 1990 in the port of Riga, Latvia. The long date of ice breakup time series was best described by a fifth order polynomial, which identified four distinct periods of climate transition. I won't go through the tables here and bore you to tears, but the bottom line to this is that between 1529 and 1990, there were many changes in the length or the duration of ice that was in the harbor. So when the thing freezes up about October of every year and then melts off about every April or May, They keep records from 1529 until 1990. They're keeping records now. Well, one year they'd have 180 days of ice, and the next year they'd have 170, and the next year they'd have 190, and so on. So they keep track of how many days is this ice in the harbor. They're interested in keeping those records because there are ships that have to come in and out of the harbor, and they want to know how many ice-free days are there. How many days a year can we get in and out of this harbor? Now, they've been keeping records here for nearly 500 years. Not quite, but nearly 500 years. And when they got all through making their study here, in conclusion, there's little or no evidence of a consistent global warming-induced reduction and the extent of Arctic sea ice, especially during those seasons when polar bears rely on it to reach their favorite food supply seals, despite what the IPCC calls the unprecedented warming of the past century. This is a key finding that undermines the claim that global warming would have a harmful effect on polar bears in the future. All right, got that? So we have to ask the question again, well, why is this controversy even out there in the marketplace to start with? Do you mean to tell me that government scientists that are working for, let's say, the BLM or the Department of Agriculture or some other government agency have never heard of this guy named Jevreva, who in 2001 reconstructed an even longer record of sea ice duration and therefore extent in the Baltic Sea? You mean to tell me that this is the only guy in the world that knows this? Boys and girls, these records have been kept in a place called Riga, Latvia, between 1529 and 1990. Hell, for 500 years, the Latvians have been keeping track of the sea ice up there. And if you want the information, you can get it. I'm going to give it to you right here. Get your pencil out here, son. www.co2science.org. That's where you want to go. www.co2science.org. And you can get this report from Mr. Jevrijev. And he's just one of 36. There's 35 more reports over there going to tell you the same thing, or something similar to it. And so what that leads me, you know, just one reporter after many others, you know, that I was watching Brian Williams the other night, and Brian, you know, came on, and he said, hey, we got this global warming thing, here's what President Obama's going to do about it. I never hear Brian Williams come out and say, hey, listen, have you heard about the Riga, Latvia study between 1529 and 1990? Says this global warming is poppycock. No, that's what we call the mainstream press. Now, the mainstream press is owned by about six people. You ever heard of a guy named Rupert Murdoch? Ted Turner? So, all of the news that we get on CBS, ABC, Fox News, and so on, all the news that comes in is filtered through these six guys. And so, if these six guys ever sat down and said, hey, we want everybody in the world to know about global warming, but we don't want anybody in the world to know about polar sea ice or polar bears increasing in population, and polar sea ice is getting thicker. How do we do that? Well, we control NBC and ABC and the news sources that you read. Now, fortunately for all of us, we've now got a thing here called the Internet. Now, the Internet is manned by a lot of different people that have a lot of different perspectives, and many of them don't have any particular axe to grind. They're not getting a million or a $10 million grant from the government by writing a report. Let me tell you a little story about how these corporations and government agencies buy the science that they want for the marketplace. When I was a kid back in the 1950s, the John Deere people came up with an idea. And it was a good idea, and it made a lot of sense. When cows go out in the field, they urinate and they defecate in the field. Unlike human beings who go to the toilet and put all of their waste products into one location, cows don't do that. They walk around in the field and they take a bite of grass and then they defecate on it. And then they take another bite of grass and urinate on it. The bottom line to this is that when you put 100 cows into a 20-acre field, that's enough feed for about 2 weeks, assuming that it's 6 or 8 inches high when you put them in. And they will eat about half of it, and they will waste the other half, and then we move them from that 20-acre field into the next 20-acre field, then we move the irrigation system in behind them, and then we irrigate that 20-acre field, which washes the manure off of the grass and the urine and so on, and then we clip it, and then we wait for about 6 or 8 weeks, and then that grass grows back up again, then we recycle it. So the John Deere people, looking at that dairyman's dilemma of about one half of the waste of the grass in there, came up with an idea. Why, instead of putting the cows in the field, don't we take machinery and go down in the field and bring the grass up to the cows? Because we'd get twice as much grass. So the question arises, well, would it be economically beneficial to take labor and machinery and go out into that 20-acre field and cut it and then haul it up and empty it into bunks, big troughs, and then let the cows eat it? In other words, we put the cows up here on a dry lot. The cows won't go out in the field and munch on grass. We'll cut the grass and stick it in a bunk and they can eat it up here in the feedlot. And the answer was, well, yeah, that would be economically viable. So the John Deere company came up with what they called a field chopper, and then they had to have a wagon that would be self-unloading, because, you know, you got tons and tons of feed. You know, you're putting in, well, to give you an idea here, a cow eats 70 tons of green feed a day, so it's not 70 tons, 70 pounds of green feed a day. 70 times 100 cows is 7,000 pounds. That's 3.5 tons. And so we're going to go down and cut 3.5 tons of green feed, stick it in this wagon, and then we're going to take it up here and unload it. And they came up with a pretty good wagon, a pretty good chopper. I know, because I used it for years. It was a good machine. And I was out chopping, and I was at the height of my glory chopping feed and feeding it to the cows and one thing and another. Around in the community, though, there were old-timey farmers that did not buy these field choppers, and they said that it was economically unviable. At the time, I was about 18 years old. What the hell would I know about economic viability? But the John Deere people said, oh, my God, you're doubling your profit because you're doubling your feed. And some of the guys that had been to the University of California, you know, at Davis campus, you know, and got a degree in agriculture, they bought into the program, and they started using field choppers and chopping and putting their cows on dry lot and milking more cows, because, you know, you get twice as much feed, you can milk twice as many cows, can't you? But then, at the end of the year, you've got all this manure up here on this dry lot, so you've got to load all this manure up, and you got to haul it down into the field. When the cows are out here defecating in the field, and it's getting spread all over the field at random in it. So you saved all of that, and then in addition to that, you know, you want to put your manure as close to the feedlot as possible so that you don't have to haul it. After all, who wants to haul it 5 miles? And so we found that the fertility of our fields went down, and after about 5 or 6 years of actual field usage, the choppers and the dry lots just disappeared. Now, the old farmers were correct in their assessment. The new ones that had been to college were incorrect. It wasn't economically viable. It actually cost more money to go down in the field, cut the feed, bring it up to the cows, and feed the cows, than it was to let the cows go down in the field, waste half of it, and eat it down there, and then bring the milk home in their bags. Now, the guys that have been to college couldn't figure that out, but the old-timers evidently were. I know old Enos Souza, he wouldn't. He said that God made them cows to eat grass, and I'll be damned if I'm going down there and cut their food and put it on a plate for them. So that was his view. Frank Rocha wouldn't do it. Now, Francis Capini did. But Capini quit after a few years because he started adding it up and said, geez, it costs more money. Now, why did the John Deere Company come out and say that it was economically viable? Well, here's the way this works. The John Deere Company goes to the University of California and says, look at this field chopper and look at this wagon that we've invented over here. I want you to test it out here and give us a report. So the John Deere Company writes a check to the university and says, here's $3-5 million. Test it out and write us a report. Now, if the university writes the John Deere Company a report that says your field chopper over here is a wonderful machine, a neat invention, but it's economically unviable. Even though the cows waste half the feed in the field, it costs more to cut it and bring it up here and then haul the manure back and put it on the field than you get out of it. Is the John Deere Company going to come back to the university and write them another $3-5 million check to test their machinery in the future? Now, if you've got any brains at all, you can see that that's a no-brainer. So the university is going to study this, and they're going to twist and dodge and use the numbers in such a way that it makes this field chopper look viable. And if it still doesn't look viable, then they'll just plain lie about it. That's just the bottom line. We'll just lie about it, period. But if they don't lie about it, then they'll just fudge and dodge the numbers, and they'll arrange the numbers. You know, there's an old adage that says, you know, figures don't lie, but liars figure. And that's what we're dealing with here with global climate change. The Arctic sea ice over the last 500 years has been relatively stable. There have been periods of warming when the sea ice was less, and periods of cold when the sea ice was less, and periods of warm when the sea ice was bigger or extended further, which is an anomaly, which leads these researchers to the conclusion that the atmospheric temperature is not the deciding factor in the extent of the sea ice. That's number one. So if the temperature, the air temperature, were 10 degrees warmer, it doesn't mean that the sea ice is going to be any less than it was last year or the year before, because they've got 500 years of studies here. Furthermore, we went through a cooling period from 1550 to 1850, a warming period from 600 to 1200, and a stable period from about 12 to 1550. So you've got warm, cool, warm, cool. You've got cycles that go on that we've been able to come to the conclusion, at least, over the last 2,000 years. We don't know what causes these, whether it's sunspots, whether it's God and the fickle finger of fate, or what it might be, but we can see that there are variations. And we are in one of those variable cycles. And the cycle right now is warming trend. Everybody's in agreement that the atmospheric temperature today is warmer than it was in 1850 on average worldwide, and that it's growing. But, does this mean that there's a crisis at hand and the polar bears are all going to disappear? The answer is no. The polar bear population in Siberia is growing. Polar bear population in other places in Canada are growing. The polar bear population where they're studying and giving us the report is in Hudson's Bay. So they're not lying to us. In Hudson's Bay, the polar bear population is decreasing, and there's a problem caused by overhunting, not by carbon dioxide. Overhunting, not carbon dioxide. Got that, boys and girls? And how do I know that? Well, the Heartland Institute put out a manual here called The Climate Change Reconsidered, the report of the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change, and if you want a copy, it's $154. And you can get it from the Heartland Institute at 19 South LaSalle Street, Suite 903, Chicago, Illinois, 60603. And the phone is 312-377-4000. Got that? Let's do it again. Phone number, 312-377-4000. Heartland Institute. They've also got a webpage, heartland.org. Got that? Heartland.org. O-R-G. About 150 pages and tons and tons of documentations and real-life studies that are going on today and have been going on over the past 500 years that absolutely and categorically debunks this climate change crap which has been fed to us and is a lie. Now I'm out of time, and I got to remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.